Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 94, section 2, which is old single column, page 1028. All right, so we just dipped our toe into this first of the several papers that not only look into how the Melchizedek missionaries engaged the various peoples as they went far and wide, but as I've mentioned several times already, the revelators use this as an opportunity to take those peoples and their religious, their evolutionary religion. And they take the opportunity to examine that evolutionary religion as it continued to go forward in the wake of the Melchizedek missionaries engaging them, so that you can see not only what impact the Melchizedek missionaries had, how long that impact may have had a significant differential on those people's thoughts, and of course how quickly or how extensively material gravity tended to just pull those people back down into their sort of natural evolutionary level of religious conception. And as we as we got into this paper, we see that with the Melchizedek teachings in the Orient, the very first thing they want to examine is the subcontinent of India. And so remember, they gave us that very initial context, kind of pre-Melchizedek missionaries and immediate aspects of what happened when the Melchizedek missionaries got there, and how there were many problems facing the Melchizedek missionaries. Just to sum it up simply, remember there was already quite a bit of complexity that they had to try to navigate, see what was, if any, was the means by which they could sort of accentuate a single monotheistic God concept and try to lift it up. And then very aggressive counter efforts against them by the Brahmin priesthood. So, in other words, you're back there in those founding Vedic times. And as you see, we start up now here this evening to look at how that immediately sort of dissipates definitive Vedism and morphs into Brahmanism. And remember, we already, they already introduced the Brahmin along with some of the very ancient deity concepts coming from the Andites, Dyaus Pitar, Indra, Agni, and remember, Agni was a residual from an even more ancient time, because the original Agni is three-headed, so you had a trinity concept from way back still being residually held onto there. You had Prajapati, you had a more of a creator individual concept that's feeding into that. Thoughts about kind of distilling an individual out of the Brahman principle. I mean, you got all this stuff happening. So do you go with that very definitive sky father, literally Dyaus Pitar, sky father? Do you go with some coalescence of the Brahman concept? Do you go with Prajapati, more creator, universal creator sort of a concept? But they had a difficult time going with anything because of the aggressive efforts of the Brahmin priesthood. And remember how they introduced where the four Vedas came from, that those were written specifically as a reactionary effort against the Melchizedek missionaries to take what they deemed, the Brahmin priesthood, to take what they deemed was the best of what they had way back then, which we don't really know now, and call it and distill it into those Vedas, starting with the Rig Veda. And how that was, we couldn't help but notice that it ends up having a lot of parallel to what happened with the Hebrews. The Hebrews kind of later on, the Vedas are happening earlier on, but same idea of culling what you have and retelling the story of your people in a way that you feel really brings the people together and counters external influences that that the priesthood, in both cases, see as threatening to, the established order. Not just the established order of a priesthood, which is, always an issue, but there was also just a genuinely belief that their basic deity concepts were the valid ones, and they didn't want them modified by some sort of revelatory or what they deemed so-called revelatory effort coming from the Melchizedek missionaries. Okay, so we can probably guess already, if it goes from Vedism to Brahmanism, it's probably going to go fuzzier, because we all have a kind of a sense of how kind of intangible the concept of the Brahman is. That's what's going to happen. But they need to explain exactly how that came about. So let's see how they tell us the story here for us.
Section 2, Brahmanism. As the Salem missionaries penetrated southward into the Dravidian Deccan, they encountered an increasing caste system. The scheme of the Aryans to prevent loss of racial identity in the face of a rising tide of the secondary Sangic peoples. Since the Brahmin priest caste was the very essence of this system, this social order greatly retarded the progress of the Salem teachers. This caste system failed to save the Aryan race, but it did succeed in perpetuating the Brahmins, who in turn have maintained their religious hegemony in India to the present time.
Okay, so again, they're reminding us of all of these details that we studied back when we did the Andite expansions in the Orient, into India specifically. And remember how you had the earlier Andite migrations into the subcontinent of India that got totally washed into all of the Sangic stock there. And, they're mentioning secondary Sangic. Remember that you had all six Sangics to some degree in India, but you definitely tended to have kind of a catch basin geographically down in the triangular, lower part, very triangular lower part of the subcontinent, the Deccan. So there was more secondary Sangic down there. In other words, people that are even more place-like, even more difficult to kind of move forward. And we're struggling with the default here, the fact that we've got Sangic races, you know, back in these days. I mean, long, long, you know, millennia before this, if Adam and Eve hadn't defaulted, all the races would have been blended together into one race, and we wouldn't have all these issues. But you definitely have them. You've got you've got peoples that very, very primitive, beginning evolution of religion notions that are, you know, just are always going to tend to be, you know, to draw efforts downward to a, you know, a low stable level evolutionarily. You know, and then as they're mentioning, on top of that, you've got the caste system, as they're saying, the essence of which is the Brahmin priesthood. So there's the Brahmin priesthood again, very aggressively thwarting them. So, I mean, the evolutionary religious soil is all the more problematic, and the resistance from the Brahmin priesthood is just as aggressive. So, yeah, you know this is not going to have a lot of success. You know, the Salem missionaries. Let's see, what else do we have in there? Just, you know, remember reminding, they told you way back in the, you know, when we talked about this before, that why the caste system? Because it was trying to somehow prevent all of that evolutionary stock from dragging the civilization down. But it failed. Just the numbers are too great. So, you know, that directional evolutionary stock, or that directional genetic stock, I should say it that way, that directional genetic stock just got washed down and into a place like phenomenon. But, you know, as we saw when we went through the evolution of religion, we know how strong priesthoods are. So priesthoods find a way. You know, it's even more straightforward that for them to find a way to stand unmoved if you've got the caste system, you know, to accentuate their efforts. And of course, a people that will submit to a caste system, obviously. See, again, and that kind of gets you back to just how place-like, you know, the people are, that they will submit themselves to a caste system. So, lot of issues. All right, what else do they tell us here?
And now, with the weakening of Vedism through the rejection of higher truth, the cult of the Aryans became subject to increasing inroads from the Deccan. In a desperate effort to stem the tide of racial extinction and religious obliteration, the Brahmin caste sought to exalt themselves above all else. They taught that the sacrifice to deity in itself was all efficacious, that it was all compelling in its potency. They proclaimed that, of the two essential divine principles of the universe, one was Brahman, the deity, and the other was the Brahman priesthood. Among no other Urantia peoples did the priests presume to exalt themselves above even their gods, to relegate to themselves the honors due their gods. But they went so absurdly far with these presumptuous claims that the whole precarious system collapsed before the debasing cults which poured in from the surrounding and less advanced civilizations. The vast Vedic priesthood itself floundered and sank beneath the black flood of inertia and pessimism which their own selfish and unwise presumption had brought upon all India.
Well, isn't that cheery? So let's step through. There's a number of points here. So there you see, as I was pointing out, and now with the weakening of Vedism. So that whole ism that, you know, was sort of that old order is holding on by its fingernails, and it's just going to be blown up by the presumptions of the Brahmin priesthood here. You know, and so, and obviously, looking forward, in the wake of that, we're going to have, you know, quote-unquote, Brahmanism is going to slowly gel together in the, you know, in the wreckage of Vedism. But notice, you know, that very first point, that, you know, quote unquote coincidentally, the Salem missionaries are showing up in India just when evolution can no longer, you know, it definitely can't push any higher in and of itself, you know, and it can't really hold the plateau. It's on the verge of falling down with material gravity. Revelation, coincidentally, you know, there are no coincidences in supremacy, is there. But free will is free will. And the opportunity to take the essence of what they had and follow the threads of truth upward with the stimulus of revelation was rejected. And so, you know, they make this point very definitively that this was a catastrophe for India. For them to reject that truth offer.
Sound familiar?
Pattern that happened 2,000 years later. Yeah, but it's, you know, I mean, it was so nearly complete, the rejection, you know, compared to, say, rejecting Jesus. As they'll point out, it made an almost intractable situation seemingly impossibly worse. It's a giant mystery, I'm sure, to most celestials on the planet how that's all going to sort itself out now. Because as they're, you know, going to point out, and I've already mentioned a couple times already last week, you know, it's not going to get simpler. It's going to get insanely more complicated as you continue forward. So, in a desperate effort to stem the tide of racial extinction and religious obliteration, they take what were the two principles. Remember, we saw those last week. If you've got a single column, they're right at the top of that page. But it's in the fourth paragraph from the end of the preceding section, they mentioned there was a couple of principles. There was what they called the deity father principle that was sometimes called Prajapati. Like I said, remember that sort of literally means creation lord. And then they had the energy divinity principle, you know, that was called the Brahman. See, so the Brahman priesthoods are going to say, well, okay, we're going to twist that kind of dual principle thing. We're going to kind of blur those two prior principles together and get it kind of even fuzzier and call it the Brahman. You know, sort of a newfangled, as it were, Brahman. And the other principle, you know, that's kind of the degree to which that deity father principle, Prajapati, was a more individuated principle and not such a, you know, a diffuse concept. That individuality is going to be taken up by the Brahmin priesthood themselves. We are the individuals. We are the fathers. Right? So, you know, nothing that you can really look up to as a father, right? You know, no, the fathers are in the plane with you and are your horizontal lords. All right, so they're corrupting, you know, what positive beginnings there were, you know, in this very selfish way. But it's, you know, there's gullible and then there's, no, I'm not that gullible. I'll submit myself to the caste system, but I'm not going to go for the fact that you're above all gods. That's a step too far. Right? The people, you know, and so the whole thing, the whole house of cards just collapsed. You couldn't push the people that far. And then that, you know, very direct way of phrasing what happened. The vast Vedic priesthood itself floundered and sank beneath the black flood of inertia and pessimism. Now, you know, you can obviously start, you know, it's dark, you know, the enlightenment is gone. What enlightenment there was is gone, and so in contrast, it's black. But of course, you know, they very purposely said it that way to remind you that, you know, whether it's orange, green, or indigo, secondary sanghic, or blends, you know, the, you know, a fairly even blend of the three gives you black. It's, you know, that boat anchor of a lot of secondary limitation, secondary sanghic limitation. You know, it's very purposeful, obviously, that they're wording it that way, you know, to remind you that you can't, in the same way the Vedic priesthood is fully aware of genetics, right? You know, they're not pretending there aren't races, that there aren't genetic differences. You know, that's why the caste system is there. You have a twofold issue in play still today. There's genetic limitations of just how much potential you have to be enlightened, right? Just how limited a receptor you are genetically. Right? Forget about, you know, and in that case, you know, again, you can completely forget about skin color, you know, and racial predicates. What's your nature? You might have lily white skin, but you might be pretty limited genetically, and you just have to appreciate I'm a limited receptor. But there's none so blind as those who will not see. Right? Okay, so you can't see to a degree because of your genetic limitations. Okay, but I mean, if you will open yourself up, you can overcome a lot of genetic limitations. Right? By using spirit over mind to reframe that mind and give it potential that it doesn't have with its natural framing from your genetics. Right? It doesn't have to be that limitedly bounded. But we're seeing that you've got both in play. You know, the willfulness of the leadership, you know, and the people who just follow blindly, now that willful leadership, and then the genetic limitations on top of it. As we pointed out many times, Gabriel may have found, you know, relatively best genetics on the planet for Michael's incarnation as Jesus. Okay. But it's not like it was the absolute best genetics on the planet. If you were to take Jesus to a planet enlightened life, you know, they would put him in a hermetically sealed bubble, you know, for fear of him genetically contaminating the planet. I mean, Jesus had, you know, severe limited genetics compared to the peoples in a world enlightened life. But that's kind of the whole point of Jesus the man. You know, even if he had all kinds of divots and distortions in his mind initially because of his genetics, he chose to rise above that, right? To reframe that. We don't want to ever, you know, forget that's always your challenge, you know. Don't bemoan your limited genetics. Take the light in cultivating. using your free will. You have an absolute dimension to your personality. You can overcome a lot. But here, it's all just getting washed down into the inky blackness of ignorance and superstition and confusion. All right, what else do we have?
The undue concentration on self led certainly to a fear of the non-evolutionary perpetuation of self in an endless round of successive incarnations as man, beast, or weeds. And of all the contaminating beliefs which could have become fastened upon what may have been an emerging monotheism, none was so stultifying as this belief in transmigration, the doctrine of the reincarnation of souls, which came from the Dravidian Deccan. This belief in the weary and monotonous round of repeated transmigrations robbed struggling mortals of their long-cherished hope of finding that deliverance and spiritual advancement in death, which had been a part of the earlier Vedic faith.
Okay, yeah, so, yeah.
I didn't know about weeds.
Yeah, right, I mean, it's, yeah. Yeah, those who are really aggressive go all the way on this stuff. You know, I mean, you know, remember you have a complimentary thing of taking all life as sacred, you know, and if all life, no matter how primitive, you know, is sacred, well, why couldn't you get reincarnated as, you know, that? The only reason they didn't bring in bacteria is because they didn't know there was bacteria, right? okay, so look at how interesting how they reframed the very definitive notions of reincarnation coming in. Why the why of it? The undue concentration on self. Just a very interesting thing to reflect on for yourself. Remember in other spots in the book, they tell you how corrosive introspection is. When you start just staring at your belly button lint, you just roll back on yourself and just, there's no end to the problems. I mean, just think kind of internally, if you have the hourglass analogy of your mind or self. That upper domain that you have by grace, because we're in circuitment in the Holy Spirit, has an innate upward orientation to it. And the more you fixate on self, the more you turn your eyes away from the light above that will naturally draw you upward. All right, the more you look down to that animal origin self, in whatever ways, I mean, like they point out, obviously you're going to be all the more aware of the fear foundation of that animal origin self. But you just, you just start going, around in circles, chasing your tail down in there. Right. The whole point of having the, in the hourglass analogy, there's that opening. It's like, oh, wait, what's up here? See, it breaks that tail chasing. But you literally just start going around and around down there, and you start to pick up on that sort of unconsciously, those circles. And you literalize them into notions like going around in reincarnation. You project that out into your theories. That tail-chasing, closed system down there. Okay? That's how that notions like that get generated. And, of course, it isn't really this sort of vertical circle that I'm doing just for convenience. It's actually everything goes flat, and everything goes down into the plane, and you're just going around and around in the plane, right? You're not going upward even in a spiral, let alone sort of more linearly upward. You're not going around this life and then starting on the first mansion world with a transcendent body and self and going around that one. No, you're something in the plane with you, an animal or even a plant. And you're stuck in the plane. Remember how the Melchizedek was trying to get people to look up from the plane. If nothing, get a Sky Father notion, something to pick your thoughts up. Right? And the more you can do that, the more you will unwittingly discover the neck and the hourglass of your mindful self. And enlightenment from the upper domain will dawn in your consciousness. All right, let's see. So all of this, of course, is, always going to be biased to the southern regions, to the Deccan, those who have less of a tendency to not be in this tail-chasing mode in the first place. And then the way the belief in the weary and monotonous round of repeated transmigrations robs struggling mortals of their long-cherished hope. It's just soul-sucking. There's been centuries of efforts by smart people to, put a fancy shine on the notion, but deep down inside, it's soul-sucking, right? Right? It's not genuinely motivating. You have to really work at trying to convince yourself that it's worth getting up in the morning so that you can reincarnate as a cricket. It's just difficult, right?
That's why I have cricket on my phone. Yeah. Learning the language now. Yeah. Getting ready for your future.
remember, they, went back when we were reading about evolutionary religion. Humans are very aggressive on rationalization schemes. We came up with lots of clever species of self-deception, right? So we could get ourselves up in the morning. But, there's limits. There's just limits, And at some point, someplace deep down, it's a clever species of self-deception, right? You aren't really enthused. You're pretending. And you know it. That was just, and again, it's all of this is, all this collapse and all of this confusion is because those who could see the Salem missionaries' revelation willfully closed their eyes to it. Not a smart thing to do. And in that not smart thing, there's a reason why they say stultifying. Right? They're trying to pick as harsh a word about it as you can. It's not just absurd and soul-sucking. It's stupid. It's so, you have to so stupefy your mind to reject that God-given instinct that you are drawn upward by spiritual gravity. To shut that off, to wall that off from your consciousness, is to effectively de-enlighten your mind, and it's as if you are literally stupid. Even if technically, you're not, you got a reasonable raw intelligence, but, it's not showing. You've stupefied yourself. You've stultified yourself. You are standing still.
Weary and monotonous.
Yeah.
I was wondering about these documented children who are born and they remember their past lives until about the age of seven, and some of them even longer, until much later, and it's documented. Even when they're born in families of Christian families who don't believe.
We all know there's information that can be interpreted. The question is, you can interpret given information in many ways. Currently, mankind thinks the only way to interpret that data is the way it's currently interpreted. The only possible explanation is that person was reincarnated and they're remembering a past life. That's because basically, see, even though those are very religious people usually that are talking about this, they've unwittingly adopted the basically atheistic scientific assumption of philosophic materialism, and they think that we're just blobs of matter. Right? No. Right? I mean, when the revelation tells you what mind really is, you say, okay, there's all kinds of possibilities for other interpretations of that data. The only interpretation isn't reincarnation. That's one of the main things that the revelation is trying to give you. Setting aside any details, it's fundamentally offering us a better set of initial assumptions. If you start with the initial assumptions that we've always had, certain sets of data can only be interpreted certain ways. You're just stuck, and those are the ways we've always interpreted them. But if you're given a bigger picture, you go, oh, wait a minute. No, there's a bunch of other possibilities. All right. Yeah, the most straightforward of which is, our mind, which is not a chunk of something that's broken off and glued onto us, right? It's a contiguous mind energy system. It can't be individuated. The best way to think about it is that mind reaches down and attunes to your genetic nature. You know, it's like, think of it as a rubber sheet, this continuum of mind, or this, maybe better to say, this ubiquity of mind, right? And think of pulling that rubber sheet down, kind of a cone, right, that then attunes and seats upon your brain and your genetic nature, and it's specifically attuned to that, so that the well, quote-unquote, of mind that you're using is only relatively unique, right? Because your genetics isn't absolutely unique. If you start with two identical twins, they're using the same well of mind to begin with, right? Because their genetics are identical, and that's why they kind of have the same thoughts. They have to begin to bring their personality into play and separate those two to start having a separate mindal nature. But, that just reminds me, what if I'm genetically similar to someone who lived 200 years ago? Which, of course, I am. And what if, because of, the lack of oversight of our genetic nature and focusing this by Adam and Eve like it should have been, we've got lots of people who are kind of not very well focused and localized in the mind energy system because of that. They're a little bit fuzzy. They can pick up on kind of a lot of things. It would be very easy for me if I was a little bit fuzzy like that, not very well localized in the mind energy system, to pick up stuff that's really close in the mind energy system, that very similar genetics from 200 years ago, say, of some individual. It's just right next to me in the mind energy system, right? And I could pick that up. And, I don't know about the physics of mind energy and stuff like I'm describing, so I'm going, well, I've got memories of a past life. The only possible explanation is I was reincarnated. No, it's not the only possible. I mean, that's the simplest explanation right there. It's just is assuming that the person is sincere and everything, and there isn't any shenanigans going on. It's very easy for them to be picking up something close in the mind energy system. And then, if you take, forget about reincarnation sorts of stories and stuff like that, but just in general, you know, if I'm kind of down in a quasi-localized well here, what if I'm not very well localized? What if I have a tendency to drift up and out a bit? I could pull in all kinds of things. I mean, this mind energy system is the creative mother spirit's mind. It literally has the experiences and memories of every single creature, mortal, that's lived in the entire local universe. Now, obviously, I'm not going to be able to go too far because the genetic difference is, you know, going to be too great. But, I mean, could I pick up on some dead language, you know, from this planet? Everyone on this planet is not that far removed from me genetically. We're all kind of in the same basic region. All I'd have to do is just go a little ways, and I could pick up some dead language from, you know, 10,000 years ago. I mean, you know, basically anything. So right, all of that weird mindal stuff, you know, has an immediate potential for explanation in the way the mind energy system really is.
Maybe that's how the gas chambers work in the minds of, or in the brains of, like, the Adam and Eve, that they can... Mm-hmm. Read each other's minds for a distance by tapping into
them. Yeah, see, the deal with those, I remember we talked about that when they were mentioning that. I mean, remember before they were downstepped and rematerialized here, those material sons and daughters are on Gerasim are like we will be up there, where, you know, you communicate mindily. Because, you know, there's contiguous mind energy between me and you. I mean, I don't have to jiggle air molecules. We can just connect through the mind energy system. And that's the way basically everyone is connecting, what we kind of loosely call telepathically. But when they downstep them, they can't do that just naturally. So they have to have this special mechanical, system in their brains that mind is resonating with, so that it amplifies this ability to communicate through the mind. Without that amplifier, they can't do it. But with the amplifier, they can, over a limited range, they can communicate, you know, mindily again.
And you know how mechanical it is, because there's a distance connected.
Yeah, there's a distance thing, you know, and it's, you know, it can only, it's a, I mean, yeah, obviously it fits inside their skull, so it's not that vast of an amplifier. It's not 600 million watt amplifier. No, I mean, it's just a, you know, a simple little resonance cavity, right, that can amplify it a little bit. Because remember, the mind energy works in a very oscillatory way. You know, as we all know from EEGs, right, there's a rhythmic pulsation in the mind energy that casts a shadow down on the brain that we pick up as an EEG. Right, so you have these oscillatory sort of phenomena, rhythmic pulsation phenomena, right, that just need to be amplified a little bit, you know, and they will damp out over a distance, but, you know, just by, you know, the same way that current has a resistance, you know, over a distance, is, you know, because it's a, you know, it's very material mind, right? So it has those kind of analogies to it. That's the basic stuff.
Kids did over 50 mile thing.
Yeah, you know, I remember we talked about, you know, you've got these special first generation for our Adam and Eve, you know, and so they aren't totally downstepped and they have some ability. Yeah, I mean, all that sort of stuff. And but yeah, back to this, you know, just, you know, yeah, that's the big thing of you know, you've got an immediate factual basis for a false interpretation of past lives. Plus, okay, you know, even setting that objective fact aside, don't ever forget you can rationalize anything, right? So, you know, you combine some factual basis with imagination and aggressive rationalizing, and you can fill in the blanks, and you can... You can convince yourself, right?
Sorry. Are the mind and brain, are they related? Does the mind survive death? How are they related?
Well, the brain doesn't survive death, and your individual mind doesn't survive death either.
Okay.
But there's three absolutely separate energy systems. There's physical energy, like what this is made out of, what my body's made out of. There's mind energy and there's spirit energy. They're three absolutely separate energy systems, their own physics, each with their own physics. And, you know, in my case, I don't have, you know, spirit energy directly as part of me. Right? We're just butting up against spirit energy in the ceiling of our mind. It's not literally incorporated in my body, say, right? But I basically have a mindful self that's attuned to, seated upon a biologic genetic foundation. And deity bridges the gap between those two energies, right? My eyeballs don't see anything, right? Right? There's all this photon stuff and stimulation, and it goes to nerves, and nerves go to the brain, right? There's things going on in the brain, but then there's that great mystery, you know, which again is explained by the revelation. Deity takes what's in that physical energy system of the brain, you know, as a nerve stimulus phenomenon, and produces a representation of that in the mind energy system, where your consciousness is, you know, and where you can become aware of something in the external world, you know, like what I see of your shirt color or whatever. All of that is carefully attuned and functioning here. But what goes on is neither my adjutant mindal self, which is a mortal self, right? If you use that analogy, when I die, the rubber sheet just pulls back up and is flat again, and my little well is not there. Right? My brain is ashes to ashes, dust to dust. We all know that just, you know, disappears, goes back into the earth. But my higher nature has been copied into an object that doesn't die when I die, doesn't, you know, melt back into the ocean when I die. That Marantia object, that soul. And, you know, that's going to come up when we get into Hinduism a little bit. That soul is what is, which is, you know, basically the brain for my new body on the next world. You know, there's a mind that's seated on that Marantia brain. That Marantia brain and its mind will be given a body for my next life, right? And that's what is resurrected. That's what goes on.
And then your TA.
Yeah, and your thought adjuster goes with it, et cetera. Yeah. You don't want to get way off in, you know, but we're going to talk about thought adjusters too when we get into this a little bit. All right, let's see. What else do we have here? Where are we? I've lost our place. Were we?
Weary and monotonous.
Let's see. We.
Vedic faith.
Oh, yeah, we ended with the Vedic faith. Yeah, okay. Yeah, so we touched, yeah, we went through all that. I was just starting to vamp on stultifying, then we got off on that tangent, yeah.
Yeah.
All right, okay, let's keep going here.
This philosophically debilitating teaching was soon followed by the invention of the doctrine of the eternal escape from self by submergence in the universal rest and peace of absolute union with Brahman, the oversoul of all creation. Mortal desire and human ambition were effectually ravished and virtually destroyed. For more than 2,000 years, the better minds of India have sought to escape from all desire, and thus was opened wide the door for the entrance of those later cults and teachings which have virtually shackled the souls of many Hindu peoples in the chains of spiritual hopelessness. Of all civilizations, the Vedic Aryan paid the most terrible price for its rejection of the Salem Gospel.
Yeah, so there, let me just start with that last statement, see? As I was hinting earlier on, of all civilizations, the Vedic Aryan paid the most terrible price for its rejection of the Salem Gospel. You know, they were the most tenuous evolutionary construct, so desperately needed that uplifting revelation. In fact, that it was so willfully rejected, things fell, and they fell terribly. You know, and so they're pointing out, not only, you know, do you have the hopelessness of, oh, my life is just an endless cycle of going around and around in a plane, but then if I get really fancy with my rationalization schemes and I dream up some way where eventually you escape from that hopeless situation, that your destiny is also hopeless and purposeless, right? You're a quasi drop of water in the ocean, and guess what? Finally, you're not even a quasi drop of water. You just melt into the ocean, right? So your life is purposeless. Your destiny is purposeless. Right? How does that not end up in nihilism in some way? You know, at least below the surface. Like I said, where you're trying to imagine that you're really holding on to something because you believe in all the falderall and whatnot. Right? But boy, deep down, I mean, there's nothing. I mean, this ocean, this Brahman ocean, you know, you can hardly, you know, it's basically, you know, the definition is it can't be defined. Right? It's defined in the negative. Take any sort of positive thought you have, and Brahman exists in contrast to that. It's not this, it's not this, it's not this, it's not this. It's this absolute negative. It's going to be pretty difficult to hold on to a sense of purpose in the midst of that. Because it fundamentally is a purposeless picture. Yeah, and you convince yourself that nothing is bliss. Let me just pause for a second. You know, how can you convince anyone that basically nothingness is bliss? Okay, because there's kind of a sort of a nothingness, a non-individuated fact, right? The continuumness of unity. See, and if you kind of begin to lift yourself up in your mind a little bit and let go of your stark individuality, you find a budding relationship with that unity fact, that continuumness, and people bliss out in that. You know, and it's formless. It's not literally void, okay? But pure unity is formless, in the sense of individuality being form. So, I mean, that's what you're playing off of. You know, you're taking that initial blissy experience of blissing out in unity, and taking it up to a philosophic abstraction of absoluteness, and calling it the Brahman.
Desirelessness is kind of bliss because you have everything, you don't desire anything.
Right, you saw what they were saying there. For more than 2,000 years, the better minds of India have sought to escape from all desire.
Yes.
Right? Because you're thinking, wait a minute, if I have a desire, I'm differentiating myself. I need to try to wash myself totally out. I have to have no direction. I have to be pure place. And I have to just let that place diffuse so that I can melt into the Brahman.
So it's all good.
And then you say it's quote-unquote all good. And see, and like I said, see, the fact that literal good is a spirit word, right, that unity sort of a thing, see, there's an essence there of truth, but right, it's taken, all good things taken to a screen become bad, basically. So if you overplay that, and make it this absolute, this singular absolute, right? Then you have nothing. When all is said and done. So, this is how a little bit of reflection can be problematic if you don't keep things grounded. All right. Anything else we have to say there? We'll get to it. Notice they said absolute union with Brahman. See, we have absoluteness coming up, like I've been kind of saying.
Caste alone could not perpetuate the Aryan religio-cultural system, and as the inferior religions of the Deccan permeated the north, there developed an age of despair and hopelessness. It was during these dark days that the cult of taking no life arose, and it has ever since persisted. Many of the new cults were frankly atheistic, claiming that such salvation as was attainable could come only by man's own unaided efforts. But throughout a great deal of all this unfortunate philosophy, distorted remnants of the Melchizedek and even the Adamic teachings can be traced.
Okay. The inferior religions of the Deccan, you know, and there's just sort of no stopping this. They developed an age of despair and hopelessness. Like I said, it's like, oh boy, it's also cheery here. During these dark days that the cult of taking no life arose. Remember, we already kind of referred to that. Any sort of, you know, you're sort of trying to get a grasp on anything. And so you just, you know, you kind of get back to animism, you know, and amp it up. And try to hold on to that kind of, it's all good, you know, if you will, sort of mentality. Obviously the corollary of that, if all life is sacred, you know, you obviously are going to deduce that you should take no life. So don't take that antibiotic, for instance. And it has ever persisted. Remember, you know, Jainism, of course, Jainism has, you know, that to a high degree. And then notice the startling thing that they're pointing out there. See, many of the new cults were frankly atheistic. This is the thing again. When the more you wash, any genuine deity, especially individuated deity concept, away, you end up getting back to your favorite object when you were a little kid. You, right? When your first word was mine, right? That object, and you know, it's frankly atheistic. See, claiming that such salvation was attainable could come only by man's own unaided efforts. It's a flavor of humanism. It's atheistic. It's all about you. And that simple fact can get lost in the almost infinite complexity of the rationalization schemes that you try to, you know, wrap your mind around that, you know, that they've spun over the centuries. It seems like you're not just holding on to yourself, but, you know, if you would just step back and see, it's like, no, I really am just putting it all on me. You know, it's kind of a an Eastern flavor of worst works righteousness. Okay. Yeah. But they pointed out, throughout a great deal of all this unfortunate philosophy, distorted remnants of the Melchizedek and even the Adamic teachings can be traced. So they give us a little positive element there. Basically saying, as hopeless as it appears today to try to penetrate through that infinite fog of complexity, there are some little threads that you could, you know, focus people in on, blow on the embers a little bit, try to lift them back up again. You know, and if we don't do it, the evolutionary process is doing it, right? The evolutionary process over long spans of time will slowly work on taking those threads of truth, pulling up out of the morass. You know, it could take countless millennia, right? But it will slowly lift them up, right? And they will sort of be rediscovered. Yeah. So even, remember, that which revelation fails to accomplish, evolution always achieves. Even if you aren't a revelatory influence for them, or some, you know, descending from above revelator, you know, isn't there, even just the evolutionary process, you know, has something to work with. It's not totally black.
These were the times of the compilation of the later scriptures of the Hindu faith, the Brahmanas and the Upanishads. Having rejected the teachings of personal religion through the personal faith experience with the one God, and having become contaminated with the flood of debasing and debilitating cults and creeds from the Deccan, with their anthropomorphisms and reincarnations, the Brahmanic priesthood experienced a violent reaction against these vitiating beliefs. There was a definite effort to seek and to find true reality. The Brahmins set out to de-anthropomorphize the Indian concept of deity, but in so doing, they stumbled into the grievous error of depersonalizing the concept of God, and they emerged not with a lofty and spiritual ideal of the Paradise Father, but with a distant and metaphysical idea of an all-encompassing absolute.
Okay, so see, now we're going to see it. We go through this, it gets totally muddled up in all sorts of anthropomorphisms and whatnot from the Deccan. But on the positive side, this Brahmanic priesthood, they just will not go away. You know, there's a positive side to it here. Okay, they try to step in and try to refocus, so coalesce something out of the out of the just the morass of the detritus of you know what's you know washed over everyone. And but you know you can kind of see that it's so muddled up now, it's not surprising that the only thing that can kind of distill out of it is not sort of, it's not some definitive individuality, but just a very unity-like essence that they sort of lift up out of the mess. And see, so now we really have Brahmanism, you know, going. This new reworked concept is going to be the central focus for a new ism, Brahmanism. But it's much more of a philosophic concept, you know, than a religious concept. When you don't have individuality, you don't have the beginnings of personality. I mean, mere individuality is not personality, but personality is absolutely unique. You know, if there isn't individuality, it has no place to identify. Right? So that's why you end up with, you know, a depersonalized, a de-godded, quote-unquote, religion. You know, and that much more science-like idea of the absolute, you know, as opposed to the religious idea of the Father. Right? The philosophy has kind of gone to the science side and given you the absolute.
Right? In their efforts at self-preservation, the Brahmins had rejected the one God of Melchizedek, and now they found themselves with the hypothesis of Brahman, that indefinite and elusive philosophic self, that impersonal and impotent it, which has left the spiritual life of India helpless and prostrate from that unfortunate day to the 20th century.
Again, you just have to marvel at how straightforward they are in describing the situation. That impersonal and impotent it, right? I'm foreshadowing a bit, but you can probably see it right there. Oh yeah, I'm basic. If as some sort of like a founding concept, it's not going to have any validity of being called the I Am, is it? It's going to be at best the It Is as a founding sort of a concept. Yeah, that's where you know what you end up with. You know, and you're lucky if you can get it out of that conceptual phase to some sort of actualization at all. You know, I mean, the I Am is not an actuality; it's a concept, right? And yeah, so you know, you kind of just get stuck in the unpacked suitcase. you never unpack the concept into any actualities.
In the I Am, you at least have the potential of I coming out of the I Am.
Yes.
You just have the It Is. Where does the I?
Yeah.
Where does the I come?
I can't come from anywhere. Yeah.
I can't be.
Right. Exactly. See, so you know, you're going to end up with again. See that, like I said, you're going to. You know, the personalized self is in the upper domain of your hourglass analogy, right? Yeah, the unspiritualized, unpersonalized mindful self in the lower domain is going to be, that's what you're going to naturally focus on because that's Brahman-like. It's it-like instead of I-like. See, so again, it just you're caught in all of the tail chasing down in the lower domain of your mere mindful self.
A lot of people think that way today.
Yep. Oh, yep.
So if people don't, you know, grow their soul. If a person didn't grow their soul, if they were like an animal, and then they would, you know, go back as if they were like a drop in the ocean. And blend in. I mean, is that kind of where they're...
Yeah, we'll get to that. I'm going to talk about some of those things specifically. They'll come up here in a little bit.
So is that kind of where they're going with that?
Yeah, you can see that's kind of, you know, some of where places they're going. Yeah, again, you know, they're going to remind you these are sublime efforts. They had some great thoughts. It's just they were missing the personal element. In all these great thoughts. Got really close to a lot of things, but it can't break free because it doesn't have that definitively encompassing, focusing fact of personality brought into the scheme. So it stays washed out. Yep.
Chris, isn't that egotistic, like I am versus God is?
There it's very important to not blur ego with egotism. Right? I mean, the capital I pronoun, right, is just basically the word ego. Right? Ego means self-aware self. A human is a self-aware self. An animal is just an aware self, right? Yeah, like it has feelings, but it's not aware of its feelings. You're aware of your feelings. Right? A capital I pronoun, the word ego, means self-aware self. That is all important, right? That's your foundation of your human nature. If you reject being a self-aware self, because you've say, well, that's a bad word. No. Egotism is bad. You know, I mean, even egoism is not bad. Right? That's just kind of innate in an immature child. First word is mine. Okay, that's egoism. Right? But that's not egotism. Right? Egotism is a totally different story. Right? That's where you're using you know, your self-awareness, in a self-exaltation over others mode. I am I, and I am greater than you. Okay, that's egotism. But, you know, you avoid that. But ego, yes, you know, that's the beginning of the real you. a self-aware self, right? Step one of beginning a reflective life is know yourself, know thyself, as you know, as we always have said about the what the Greeks recognized. Right? Start out by taking a hold of your self-aware self, your that reflective vantage point that goes, oh, wait a minute, let's take a look at this mindful self that I have here, as opposed to just being down into it and just going with its flows, oblivious, and constantly tripping over things, you know, and going, well, who could have ever guessed that that would happen? Well, someone who doesn't have their head down in their self sand can know that, right? You lift your head up, become aware of yourself, and you become aware of the world around you too. Right, that's very important. Ego is not a bad word. to try to shove your ego away is to depersonalize yourself. You don't want to do that. We got plenty of effectively fancy animals on the planet. We need some humans. We need someone who's reflecting.
Chris,
yep.
With children, I've noticed it's good to foster their ego, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not make them egotistical, but
right.
It is ego that we're...
Again, because if you don't take a hold of your individuality in a budding, personalized way, how are you ever going to be a fully realized personality? I mean, your personality was given to you by the Universal Father. It has to identify with an individuality. You need to individuate yourself. I mean, you know, a lot of these Eastern thoughts, you know, the degree to which they're kind of not just Eastern, but universal on the planet, are exactly counter to your real beginning mission. You know, all of this trying to rejecting self and fuzzing out into some continuum, believing that that's what you're supposed to do because ego is bad. It's like, no, the very first thing you do when you begin to ascend in the cosmos at the local system level is to fully individuate. Right? And once you are a definitive individuation, a personalized individuality in a full definitive way, okay, then you go up to the next notch at the constellation level, and we're going to work on associating those very definitive individualities. And then and only then, up at the local universe headquarters level, do we address you as an individual sort of directly relating to unity. Because only then will you not sort of wash yourself out. Because you have an individual integrity you established first, and then you establish definitive connections to others. So how difficult will it be for you now in that third step to wash out? You'll have to melt an unmeltable you, and you'll have to drag other unmeltable individuals in there with you because you're attached to them. You're not going to diffuse into the continuum.
Chris, the three things, body, mind, spirit, is spirit also part of the individual personality or the merging?
For us right now, because my immediate nature doesn't have spirit energy in it, but there is a spirit fact. That's the thought adjuster. You have a body, you have a mind, and you have a spirit fragment within your mind. You have a thought adjuster. That is a very kind of immediate relationship to that other energy. It's not innately a part of you yet. You have to mature and fuse with it. But it's intimate with you. So you have a direct example of goodness within you that you can identify with, as well as your mind and the individuality of your body.
As far as we can tell, it is God.
Right, and that,
well,
yeah, it's so good that, right, that fragment is so the spirit of goodness that it's effectively the goodness of God that you can understand, right? It's like having God right there.
But then it would be unity with all rather than separation. So it would be a step towards a joining.
But see, that's the thing about that. That's a spirit fragment. There's spirit energy that is a continuum. But you have an individual. You have a thought, and the two can't melt together. See, so again, the more you identify with that spirit fragment, the more we are not melting into the ocean, like of the Brahman. All right. So let's see. What else we have here? Okay. So you have the earliest. You have the Vedas, and then you bring in the Brahmanas. And then you bring in some of the oldest Upanishads, the Upanishads go on and on and on. They're still being generated today. There's like 200 or something of them. But you've got the ones that that go way back. And including some that were pre 6th century BC. So definitely pre-Buddhism coming into play and, complicating things all the more there in India. Not to mention, eventually you have Mohammedanism, you have Islam, and you have Christianity, and all that complicates India even more. All that stuff gets woven into Upanishads. So you end up with, all of that complexity of literature. Let's see, anything else there? Just they italicized that true reality. There was a definite effort to seek and to find true reality. So this is kind of becomes this, they're going to find quote-unquote true reality. And you can see that, if you know anything about studying Brahmanism, Hinduism, that effort. But a grievous error. Right? It's just it's so problematic to ever more willfully move your conception of reality away from personality. And it's not just the Indians that have done that. I mean, it's been many, many different isms that have been spawned in that mode. It's like what is sort of the foundational principle? I think it's process. Let's write a book called Process and Reality. No, it's not process, right? Or Brahman or any other principle, conception, concept, personality. Right, that's what you want, personality and reality. And that's what so many philosophic efforts have missed. And they take some lesser concept and try to aggrandize it into a complete lifestyle solution. All right.
It was during the times of the writing of the Upanishads that Buddhism arose in India. But despite its successes of 1,000 years, it could not compete with later Hinduism. Despite a higher morality, its early portrayal of God was even less well-defined than was that of Hinduism, which provided for lesser and personal deities. Buddhism finally gave way in northern India before the onslaught of a militant Islam with its clear-cut concept of Allah as the supreme God of the universe.
Okay, so you see at the beginning there, it was during the times of the writing of the earliest Upanishads that Buddhism arose in India. Just notice the interesting little twist they threw in there. So we were talking how negative it was that we had all of this kind of anthropomorphic, lowercase g gods and whatnot stuff washed into, along with kind of more technically Brahmanism. But you get Buddhism in there, which is even making an additional effort to try to wash personality away. And see, it could not compete with later Hinduism. despite a higher morality, its early portrayal of God was even less well-defined than that of Hinduism, which provided for lesser and personal lowercase d deities. Remember, we're using lowercase d deity to kind of match up with lowercase g God, because even if this is, gets really kind of intense in a, as a philosophic effort, and you get something that's kind of beginning to be a little bit capital D deity-like, it's still a bottom-up sort of attempt at this. So you shouldn't capitalize the D. You know, you should remind yourself that this is, you know, this is just kind of sort of quasi-capital D deity notion. Right? It's a lowercase d deity notion. It's an effort to think about that which isn't a thing. See? And that's where the appropriateness of using the word deity is. You know, it's a non-thing concept. But it's not nothing. It's just a non-thing concept. But it's not very objective. It's coming bottom up. It has a lot of subjective confusion to it. You bring in, you know, Islam, let alone militant, you know, spreading Mohammedanism by the sword. And notice that they said Islam here instead of Mohammedanism. You know, they use both. It's important. You know, they want to differentiate between, you know, an ism that is very focused on the individual Muhammad and sort of an aggrandizement around that. So it's technically Mohammedanism, which is very innately militant. Eventually distilling an essence out of that that is more, it's appropriately given a different name to differentiate it. You know, it's not so focused on the individual. Okay, and that you can call that Islam. When it's Islam, it begins to also move away from the militantism. Right? I mean, you know, those Muslims that have really been able to overcome that militant, you know, spreading by the sword origin. And I see they're Muslims of Islam, very directly. But you know, the individual, you know, that calls himself a Muslim and is very militant, it's like, well, no, they're more a Mohammedanist, right, than a Muslim. Right? It's really Mohammedanism that they identify with, not so much Islam. And you know, notice that they're using the Islam here because there will be a tendency when you interface with this very unity, Brahman, you know, continuumness scheme in India, it will have a tendency to, you know, to actually perhaps move you away from such a fixation on Muhammad. I mean, you don't even have a personalized God, right? See, so, you know, so there is, that's why they're saying Islam there. Just, you know, pointing out that potential is there. Yeah. But of course, we know that there's still a lot of, you know, fighting back and forth. You know, we even have a separate country now of Pakistan, right? Right, because of it. Okay, all right. So there's, you know, there's the Brahmanism. See, now they want to talk a little bit more about the Brahmanic philosophy, you know, itself. You know, and some of these things you were hitting on, Katie, you know, a minute ago, of how, just how, you know, if you really push away all the silliness, kind of look at some of the essence of some of their core concepts. It's they're very pregnant. They're getting close to a number of ideas that you can see the full flower of those, you know, in the Revelation. You know, as a student of the Revelation, you can look at that element in Hinduism and go, oh, look it, they got really close to that part of reality there, or that aspect of deity there. So that's kind of what they do in this next section.
Section 3, Brahmanic Philosophy. While the highest phase of Brahmanism was hardly a religion, it was truly one of the most noble reaches of the mortal mind into the domains of philosophy and metaphysics. Having started out to discover final reality, the Indian mind did not stop until it had speculated about almost every phase of theology, excepting the essential dual concept of religion. The existence of the universal father of all universe creatures, and the fact of the ascending experience in the universe of these very creatures, as they seek to attain the Eternal Father, who has commanded them to be perfect, even as He is perfect.
Okay, that latter part we've emphasized quite a bit, but
that's what it's all about,
right? Yeah, I mean, kind of missing that core framework, but apart from that, they had a lot of deep reflective efforts. Right? I mean, these were earnest, sincere individuals, at the core of many centuries of effort. And definitely if you say Brahmanism instead of Hinduism, even more so, you're not really talking about a religious ism. And, it's... remember when we talked about evolutionary religion, in general, none of evolutionary religion is in fact religion, right? It's just sort of in truth religion, right? It's because all of these notions about, fanciness of the external world that evolutionary religions are fixated on, it isn't purely that. It has a sort of an unconscious motivation of a genuine superconscious religion within each of us that we have by grace that casts a shadow down into the conscious domain that everyone's playing with and thinking about fancy imaginary outer life things, the ghost cult. So it's, you can call it a religion because it is in truth, even though it isn't consciously in fact a religion. Right? They're not thinking about eternity, they're thinking about time. Brahmanism, they're just pointing out it's even more one step removed. So it's hardly a religion. And it's going to get into some confused areas because it's going to attempt to be a metaphysics, right? Humans can't generate a metaphysics. We talked about that a couple of weeks ago. Right? If you think about the whole sphere of true philosophy, the lower hemisphere, the human philosophy, is what we can generate. But the upper hemisphere, the metaphysics, you can't get, no matter how much you strive for it, in a bottom-up effort. You can only get at it from the top down, and our limited ability to get things from the top down is why there's revelation, right? I mean, basically a metaphysics has to be revealed to you. I mean, that's what this book is a true metaphysics, right? The thing that humans have always been trying to generate and can't, right? They generate all sorts of foolishness. Right? It's that upper framework. It's the half of the picture that you combine with the best of human philosophy to begin to get a full picture.
Which in normal worlds has a revelatory process.
Yeah, right. A whole revelatory process where that metaphysics is initiated and advanced throughout hundreds of thousands of years. Yeah, in every world. Yep.
What about mythology versus metaphysics and philosophy? Where, many consider Bible to have metaphysics, So what about that mythology and like stories? And so they get metaphysical truth from those mythological stories. They have long, long stories.
Right. There's a lot of stuff that we call metaphysics. You know, and if you want to continue to call it metaphysics, you just need to recognize it's false metaphysics, in contrast to true metaphysics. I mean, it's an attempt, see, to provide an initial assumption framework, and you try to convey some of those kind of founding principles or framework through stories, mythological stories, to try to kind of explain the why behind it all. Humans have always been trying to do that. But we have to all just be very humble and recognize that you can't really do that, because you just need to be told what the big picture really is. And then you can rework what we can get our minds wrapped around within that context, right? So that your theory about the origin of man, or that's told in some mythology, or your theory about the origin of the universe that's told in some mythology, or what. So those theories can be true theories, or at least you can work on moving them to come into harmony with the metaphysical, objective framework. That's what the revelation is here to give us, is what we've always been striving for. We know we need it. You can't just have deductive reasoning. Every line of reasoning has an initial assumption that humans pull out of something they call a metaphysics, right? There's some initial predicate, right, to every line of thought. It doesn't just come out of nowhere. You start with A, and that goes to B, that goes to C. How do you figure out where to start? Right? Do you start with the turtle back model of the universe? What do you start with? and that's what humans have always known. They need to have some starting point. And we've always been kind of suspicious that we didn't quite have it, because we'd start with some starting point we think is it, and we keep working, and then it starts to get kind of mushy and fuzzy, and I don't know. It something feels like it's not right. It's like, did I make a mistake somewhere? It's like, no, most likely it's getting absurd because you didn't start with truth. You didn't start with the true framework. That's why it's getting fuzzy after 58 steps.
Yeah.
That's just the way it is. And that, this is giving us, you see, what humans are always normally given or beginning to give us. It's like, start with this assumption. Well, I don't know. That's not the assumption we've always been. Come on, just be brave. Try it. Try this. Think of it as a hypothesis. Try this initial assumption and see if it works better. If you have the courage to actually start with one of these initial assumptions, you make an amazing discovery. It's like, oh my goodness, I can actually sort stuff out, right? And the next thing you've got some question that humans have never been able to come up with even the most fanciful, mythological, imaginary answer to. You're going, well, I can answer that question. What's the deal? I'm not even remotely the smartest person that's ever lived. What gives? How can I answer that question? Do you suppose this is actually a valid starting framework? Yeah. I mean, and eventually after you've, tested it 150 times like that, I think maybe I can just go with the fact that it says it's the authoritative elimination of error. It's a set of initial assumptions that actually work. Instead of rationalizing my relationship to God through Jesus with the atonement doctrine, how about if I start with a different initial assumption?
This brings me around back to the question you had earlier about what survives life after death. So when you're resurrected in the mansion worlds, you don't have this problem because you have a different mind. That compensates for metaphysics, so to speak. It's hard for us to understand that or imagine it now, but these things that we now get revelation for, whatever, with a mode of mind, I think we have a whole different perspective in being able to perceive that. As we move forward and up the scale in life after death.
Yeah, that mode of consciousness, it not only means that you don't have sort of metaphysics as a separate fact so much, because, see, it's sort of more innately that spherical philosophic consciousness. It also means that science and religion are less and less separate facts too, or are incorporated, you know, within. You know, like they tell you, even on a normal world, which is agitated mind, you know, well developed, you leave behind science and religion as separate things, and you just have philosophy in this moda like holistic way, and the what used to be science is just the cosmology aspect of that philosophy, and what used to be religion is just the divinity aspect of that philosophy. Right? It becomes all integrated. That's what moda, you know, is doing. It's allowing you to get this integrated into one system with you know, just different
to experience that
phases
one.
To it. Yeah,
looking forward to that one.
Yeah, to have that kind of upfront integrated approach to things, you know. Not having to have it all broken into parts and try to somehow synthesize it together. You know, you can start with the synthesis and then work into the parts. Yeah. All right. So, see, they started out to discover final reality. And it didn't. The Indian mind did not stop until it had speculated about almost every phase of theology, excepting, right. Yeah, the basic personal foundation points. Yes. All right. What else do they say?
In the concept of Brahman, the minds of those days truly grasped at the idea of some all-pervading absolute. For this postulate was at one and the same time identified as creative energy and cosmic reaction. Brahman was conceived to be beyond all definition, capable of being comprehended only by the successive negation of all finite qualities. It was definitely a belief in an absolute, even an infinite being. But this concept was largely devoid of personality attributes and was therefore not experienceable by individual religionists.
So notice how, you know, when people today kind of pick up on what got into Western thinking through some of the late 19th century philosophers that ended up kind of in the same mode, you know, that they conceived of the unknowable. And religionists and their fuzzy thinking go, oh, I like that. That I think the philosophers are talking about God, the unknowable. No, okay. If it's unknowable, it's not God, right? Like they're saying here. Therefore, not experienceable by individual religionists. Right? Yeah, I mean, the reason that God is knowable is because God is a person, is a personality, and you have a personality. And if you get rid of personality, see, you have a depersonalized self that's in this hopeless state, like we've talked about. And on the other side, you've got this intangible, unknowable, Brahman sort of concept. And see, like I said before, capable of being comprehended only by the successive negation of all finite qualities. It's not that, it's not that, it's not that, it's not that, it's not that. You know, and as you try to make the list infinite, you fuzz into a mystical feeling that you somehow you know, recognize the Brahman or something. But yeah, it's fundamentally a negative concept. Because you're overemphasizing, well, it's transcendent of that. It's transcendent, okay, but you can't make it infinitely transcendent or then it's nothing. Okay? You just play that too far.
It has to be relatable.
What was that?
Somehow it has to be relatable.
Somehow, right. Yeah, there has to be something that you can get a hold of. It just can't be an infinitely transcendent intangible. That doesn't get you anywhere. Let's see, anything else there? Like I said, the all-pervading absolute, so you got that absoluteness concept.
coming in. All right, yeah, keep going.
Brahman Narayana was conceived as the absolute, the infinite it is, the primordial creative potency of the potential cosmos, the universal self existing static and potential throughout all eternity. Had the philosophers of those days been able to make the next advance in deity conception, had they been able to conceive of the Brahman as associative and creative, as a personality approachable by created and evolving beings, then might such a teaching have become the most advanced portraiture of deity on Urantia, since it would have encompassed the first five levels of total deity function, and might possibly have envisioned the remaining two.
Okay, so now here's where we get into the full deepness. For those of you, you know, who those words aren't ringing a bell for you, means you haven't taken the Total Deity Seminar. But remember, they're hearkening back to section one in the foreword, right? The section about capital D deity before the section about capital G God. And you have the seven functional levels of total deity, you know, back there on, you know, literally page two, right, in the single column, right? Static, potential, associative, creative, evolutional, supreme, ultimate. And the various things that they, the labels that they give you, hints about what's going on, like with static, it's self-contained and self-existent deity. With potential, it's self-willed and self-purposive deity, etc. Okay, so now, there, back in the foreword, they're talking about capital D deity. And you notice they pointed out that you were beginning to get towards that capital D deity, see? But it's very interesting. They're saying you're sort of getting, you're playing with, instead of the seven functional levels of total capital D deity, right? Yeah, it's a lowercase d deity, kind of parallel initial conception. You're kind of paralleling capital D deity from the bottom up, kind of beginning notion of the differentials between those seven functional levels. They list them out, you know, their static potential, you see, associative, creative. And then as they say, you know, evolving beings, see, again, bringing in that evolutional level a little bit. Remember that ancient peoples had a much more immediate recognition of evolution that got lost and had to be rediscovered in the 19th century. Right? So having it being evolving, you know, thinking that way back, that was a more natural thing for those more ancient peoples to do. Right, and then whether or not you could finally kind of differentiate supreme and ultimate out of that, they're saying, you know, well, maybe, you know, you're getting there. And now, fundamentally, why are they getting, you know, even remotely close to such an advanced thing as the seven functional levels of total deity? It's because, even though they took it too far, they were going, well, it's not that, it's not that, it's not that. Okay? And all the that's, you know, like the, how did they say that? Finite qualities, right? All is kind of a quality of things. See? They're sort of backing into it's not thing. See, and that's fundamentally what the word deity in the Urantia book sense is referring to. Non-thingness. There's reality, which is literally is Latin for thingness. And in contrast to reality, you have non-thingness, deity. Deity and reality. Right, so that's why, you know, the more they contemplated apart from thingness, they're kind of backing into non-thingness deity. Right? And they'll get kind of the basic quality sorts of patterns, even if they aren't literally thinking of deity as a substance, like capital DD capital D, deity is. But that's what's happening there. They're just pointing out how deep their reflections are going, that, you know, this is starting to differentiate into, you know, levels.
So had they accepted the Melchizedek teachings, this is basically what they're saying, what they could advance to.
Well, if, see, there's the interesting thing. If they'd accepted Melchizedek teachings, maybe they wouldn't have gone off on this very philosophic quest for true reality and wouldn't have gotten, you know, they would have gone more of a Western mode that kind of fixates on individuality and apart from unity. But, see, but because they rejected it, see, it's not all bad. They actually gave mankind some beginning reflections heading towards deity that probably they wouldn't have gone to, you know, if they'd fixated on individuality, because the fundamental quality of deity is unity, right?
Yeah. Interesting that they did it in search of reality.
Yeah, right, of course. Yeah. Again, see the irony, like I said, they're backing into deity in their quest for reality, right?
We ended up with deity.
Because what they're doing is saying, not reality, in their quest for reality. So see, they didn't even recognize they were backing into deity.
Which reminds me of a Gandhi quote where he said, Christianity were really to follow the teachings of Jesus, all India would be Christian today. Because, I think they talk about that later.
It's coming up, yeah.
But it's interesting. And what you just said was interesting, too, is that they would have gotten to this point if that had happened at that time.
Yeah. Remember,
now
there's
that they got to this point, maybe it's time for that.
Well, it reminds you of you know, what a vast conspiracy is afoot. You can have rebellions, defaults, you can have hopeless, willful ignorance. Yeah, okay, but the supreme mind takes everything forward, right? I mean, we're all parts within a whole. And the whole wins.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, no matter how hard we try, I mean, no matter how hard Lucifer and all of his cohorts tried to separate from reality, right, in the end, the Supreme Mind just takes everything they did and turns it around to good. Right? And it takes it forward.
How fascinating this planet must be for all those student visitors to say, gee, exactly what you're saying. Yeah. They can see this happening that they don't necessarily see happening in a normal planet.
Think about how few planets develop this sublime Brahmanistic sorts of notions. Yeah, very few, obviously.
And yet get through it eventually, That's interesting.
Yeah, it's just, yeah. I mean, it's always good to remind, especially since they were so negative in so many things, it's always important to remind yourself that no matter how hopeless your life may seem or hopeless the planet might seem, it all will eventually come around. Right? And when all is said and done, there are no coincidences, there's no accidents. It all works together.
Wonders never cease.
Yeah. You just let go of your fear. It's all going to hell in a handbasket.
Yeah, black ooze everywhere. Right. But look at that. Look what they did with that.
Right.
Chris, do you think in the last, let's say, 2,000 or 2,500 years, perhaps less people died in war in India versus, Middle East, let's say? Because it was a more peaceful religion, perhaps. No.
Well, we all know the Punjab has issues.
I know.
You even start up a whole new religion of Sikhism, and what's that sword about? It's pretty I mean, war is innate, right? War is natural. It's. War is indispensable in the early process of evolution. So it's very difficult for us to be leaving war behind. But back to this. So you bring in this Narayana, this Brahman Narayana. The Narayana part is sort of a budding, quasi-individuation sort of a notion attached to Brahman. You know, you know, I mean, if you think about it, you know, just to say something like the absolute, the infinite, it is the primordial creative potency. You're putting words, you know, you're individuating. Right? I mean, if you absolutely de-individuate, you know, there are no words, right? So, you know, they recognize that. And see, so that's kind of embedded in the Narayana. There, you know, there's this sort of quasi-individuation sense that you're playing with its specificity anyway, right, to some degree. And that's so you can kind of have a universal self. See, the Narayana part gives you, like, you have a quasi-individuated self in the contiguous mind energy system, right? So there's a self, see, that's kind of gets brought into play in their thinking. A very transcendent, intangible self, but a self nonetheless. Let's see, anything else there? No, let's keep going.
In certain phases, the concept of the one universal oversoul as the totality of the summation of all creature existence led the Indian philosophers very close to the truth of the Supreme Being. But this truth availed them not, because they failed to evolve any reasonable or rational personal approach to the attainment of their theoretic monotheistic goal of Brahman Narayana.
You gotta love it. And notice they're help. You know, it's one of the places where they are very direct in what I try to bring out all the time, the difference between reasonable and rational. You know, the relativists are trying to get us to use the word rational as that most minimal word. You know, and step one is separating reasonable from it. You know, reasonable is above merely rational, and logical is above merely reasonable. You know, to get those three words separated, mm-hmm. Reasonable involves rational. Yeah, you have a rational line of reasoning, but the starting point isn't just pulled out of thin air. Right, it's a reasonable starting point. So that the line is reasoning, okay, instead of just mere rationalization. In other words, it's predicated on causality and fact. It's you're using the first cosmic intuition to start up the line, you know, of reasoning. But the fact that, you know, set aside reasonable. They couldn't come up with anything that was just merely rational. That you can rationalize anything, okay. But even the best of minds were, you know, couldn't get that far. Get a smarter mind like Lucifer. Okay, maybe he could have rationalized it, but humans were, you know, couldn't even find a way to merely rationalize it. So that's saying a lot. But here's where, there, besides things that are kind of like the absolute, you have no, because you get this kind of self thing, you start to get something that's close to issues relative to the supreme level, instead of going all the way up to the absolute level. For instance, here, notice summation. The one universal oversoul concept that they have is as the totality of the summation of all creature existence. Okay, you have the upwelling part relative to the finite that is literally is the summation, okay? The almighty part of the supreme. That upwelling part is the summation part. And the degree to which you think of just that summation culminating in a transcendent, the supreme being, right? Like they're saying, you know, they're getting close to the kind of the truth of the supreme being. I mean, it's valid to think of that transcendent, absonite being, the supreme being, as the oversoul. Okay. And then having this summation coming up. See, what are they missing, though? Right, you don't just have the upwelling, the Almighty, the summation. You have the downwelling, focalization, the mother. You know, they're missing the personal purposive half. They just have the power pattern upwelling, but they have the it part.
Yeah.
Remember? You know, the transcendent being is the he. Down in the finite, the downwelling personal purposive is the she, and the upwelling power pattern is the it. Right, well, yeah, obviously they're going to get it. They're kind of all predicated on the it is part. See, so they were getting, see, close to the Almighty within the Supreme, culminating in an oversoul, quote-unquote, the Supreme Being.
They got the part that they could get,
yeah,
because that's,
yeah,
their origin.
Yep, yep. And we already said, you know, they're kind of doing the lowercase d, 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 it's all bottom-up sort of stuff, see, so. and they're going to miss the personal purpose of be it he or she. All right, so that, but they've, see, they've got that a little bit. Okay, what else?
The karma principle of causality continuity is, again, very close to the truth of the repercussional synthesis of all time-space actions in the deity presence of the Supreme. But this postulate never provided for the coordinate personal attainment of deity by the individual religionist, only for the ultimate engulfment of all personality by the universal oversoul.
And so again, see, I mean, even apart from something that's more immediately like the oversoul, just that, like you're saying, just the karma principle, you know, is a summation thing. You know, there's the karma, you know, the summation of your whole life that's the predicate for the next one. See, again, it's that, it's all in this it part, the summation part. You know, but see, but even getting out the, not only, you know, that there's that, you know, thinking more individually, that you have a summation, and then all those individual summations get summed into a grand summation. Right? See, they're picking up on some of the elements. You know, the part of my life that doesn't have individual meaning, right? You know, is what feeds into the Almighty, my contribution to the upwelling part, the Almighty. You know, the degree to which I haven't individuated my drop from the ocean, so it has individual meaning. All of the other meaning is not mine, but the Almighty's, the summations. All right. Let's see, anything else there? Again, just, you know, coordinate personal, like I said, you know, the personal purpose of the mother, the coordinate facet to the Almighty. And then the synthesis of the two, or the integration of the two into the Supreme, and then God the Supreme. Yeah, they're missing all that, you know, that more complicated stuff, but they have the beginnings. They have the kind of the bottom-up part of it.
The philosophy of Brahmanism also came very near to the realization of the indwelling of the thought adjusters, only to become perverted through the misconception of truth. The teaching that the soul is the indwelling of the Brahman would have paved the way for an advanced religion had not this concept been completely vitiated by the belief that there is no human individuality apart from this indwelling of the universal one.
Yeah, you know, vitiated, you know, just completely fractured and disrupted. So here, if you kind of get away from the oversoul sort of stuff and kind of just think more directly about Brahman, like they're pointing out, there's again a parallel there. You know, if you just focus, if you don't think you have a soul, see, even if you call it a soul, but if you think you have just a spirit, right, in the degree to which, you know, you look at the thought adjuster, and that's not really you, right? That's a fragment of the Father. Right? So, see, they're kind of getting that parallel. The parallel of the adjuster relative to the Father as deity, the Father. So not person, you know, not the universal Father, but the deity, the Father. The adjuster, the Father, is kind of like Atman and Brahman. Right? That Atman concept, which is, you know, you have the Brahman and sort of just the Brahman within you is the Atman. But it's not you, right? I mean, you die, it, you know, melts back into the ocean, into the Brahman. See, that, you know, there's a bit of truth to that. If you go to iniquity, right, you're never going to fuse with that adjuster. That adjuster kind of just goes back into, you know, what it came from. You know, even though we know technically it's not going to melt back in like that because it's fragmented. But sort of in truth, see, they've got it. And that's what they're getting at. Now, the one little aside here, okay, that's non-dualistic Hinduism. In dualistic Hinduism, instead of kind of thinking what they're talking about is kind of being like the spirit of you, in dualistic, it's more like your soul. Right? The whole, you know, the idea that there is something that's separate, instead of just kind of the continuum just playing with you for a while and it's not really yours. Right? In that dualistic Hinduism, you know, instead of having like Atman, Brahman, you can kind of use more directly like the Hindu Atma, and in contrast that is Paramatma, supreme, in other words, Atma and supreme Atma, soul and over soul, supreme soul. See, that in dualistic Hinduism, it isn't so dreary a destiny point. I mean, so that's still holding on to, you know, you really are something. You aren't just an illusion. You aren't just, you know, Brahman playing, you know, like it was an individuality, and it really isn't. There really is an individuality. And that's more of a soul concept than the spirit concept. See, so they didn't bring that up here, but that's kind of between the lines of that. In dualistic Hinduism, you know, it is, has a little bit more relationship to the facts. It kind of isn't just sort of kind of in truth. You know? It's a little bit closer to the facts of your individuality and your separation from the ocean, from the oversoul.
Now, Chris, yeah. What about the Buddhism, that there is no Atma?
We'll get to Buddhism like, you know, after this later. But yeah, see, that has its own, like they pointed out, right, you've got a lot, it's a lot more complicated, you know, to find a personal or individuated thing in Buddhism. Like they said, because you didn't get rid of all the individuation in Hinduism, it's there to kind of slowly feed back in and give a dualistic Hinduism, for instance. Its complexity is a double-edged sword. It helps and it hinders. All right, let's keep going.
In the doctrine of the merging of the self-soul with the oversoul, the theologians of India failed to provide for the survival of something human, something new and unique, something born of the union of the will of man and the will of God. The teaching of the soul's return to the Brahman is closely parallel to the truth of the adjuster's return to the bosom of the Universal Father. But there is something distinct from the adjuster which also survives, the moranchal counterpart of mortal personality. And this vital concept was fatally absent from Brahmanic philosophy.
And that pure non-dualistic. But even when you go dualistic, the question is, can you really hold it separate, or you just have it delayed, and eventually, you know, it, the drop of water melts into the ocean. The soul melts into the oversoul. But, you know, at least there's a potential there. And then, you know, see, they're talking a little bit more, like I said, that the Atman Brahman is like the adjuster, the father. The deity of the father, in this case, they're referring to the bosom of the universal father there. The facet of deity of the father that is the closest to the mother, bosom. I remember you can even look like, I haven't pulled out one of these charts in a long time. You know, you know, just remind yourself the hierarchy of the cosmic mothers, right? You know, in a gray box here in brackets. You know, it's not technically one of the cosmic mothers, but it's the predicate, right? At the infinite level, the infinite upholder, part of the father, right? On Deventington, right? You have a very pure presence of that facet of the father, the infinite upholder, because remember, it's out of that facet that is fragmented. An adjuster is fragmented out of that facet of deity. That's what they're... See, they're, you know, not only are they getting into the functional levels of total deity, they're bringing in a number of kind of advanced things here between the lines.
So the name of that chart was...
Oh, the psychic circles and the sevenfold, for those who are listening to a recording. You can get in the library, the psychic circles and the sevenfold chart.
Can you move it over in front of the camera?
And I can move it over here in front of the camera here, too. You can see. But just that, you know, that's what they're, you know, hinting at between the lines there. anything else there?
No, but here again.
Oh, yep.
And even in today's religions, you know, that without the revelation, we would not really understand what they were talking about.
Yeah.
I mean, even Christianity, which is maybe, as they say, the more advanced, some of these concepts, you know, about the adjuster, really, you know, they just really aren't brought out.
Yeah, remember, a lot of these things I'm saying, they aren't even stated directly in the book, right? You have hints to them, and as you unpack, follow the truth, you know, you begin to figure out some of these things. Yeah, I mean, there's a... You know, to be able to see how close some of the Brahmanic reflections got to the truth, you have to go beyond just reading the Aranja book, even, right? I mean, you have to really develop it more. You got to follow those hints that they give you there in section one of the foreword I was just reminding of. Combine that with what they say in paper 105 and really unpack total deity, put that all together. I mean, but you know, the more that you've unpacked it, the more you can see how, without the fifth epical revelation or anything, just using their encircuit and the Holy Spirit and their personal ability to reflect to the best of their sincere ends, right, you can get close. All right, final little bit here.
Brahmanic philosophy has approximated many of the facts of the universe and has approached numerous cosmic truths, but it has all too often fallen victim to the error of failing to differentiate between the several levels of reality, such as absolute, transcendental, and finite. It has failed to take into account that what may be finite, illusory on the absolute level may be absolutely real on the finite level. And it has also taken no cognizance of the essential personality of the Universal Father, who is personally contactable on all levels from the evolutionary creature's limited experience with God on up to the limitless experience of the Eternal Son with the Paradise Father.
A lot of that you should ask yourself. How many things have you failed to keep in mind as you've studied the Arantia book for decades? Right? Yeah. Are you getting absolute, transcendental, you know, or absonite and finite separated and keeping them separated as you go forward thinking? Are you thinking critically as you're studying the book, or do you let those blur together? and get just as confused as they tended to get. It's a very yes. complicated picture, right? To get separated and to keep separated. So easy. I mean, but eventually you've got to be able to think very precisely about the difference between God the Father and God the Absolute. You know, and that's like, well, where do you even start in the ghost cult with that differentiation? And just the things they say there, you know, how many times have you failed to take into account that what may be finite illusory on the absolute level may be absolutely real on the finite level? But
absolute level.
But see, you know, again, this little bit of fuzzing out. See, the more transcendent it got, you know, you begin to lose your grip on the finite, you know, and start to think that the finite is just an illusion. It's like, well, yeah, if you literally put yourself purely in the absolute level, there's no finite. You're on the absolute level. Okay, but that doesn't mean that there is no finite. Right? You're just not focusing on it right now. Yeah. Many people in Western religion have done that too. They get so focused on absoluteness, they get really confused about, you know, our finite relationship to reality. You know, St. Augustine, you know, for instance, had his issues in that way. You know, but being able to, you know, if you can reflect on that sentence and get it all clear in your mind, that's a great first start to pulling yourself out of your old wineskin. Right? If you can think that through, if you can get that all clear in your mind, what do they mean by absolutely real on the finite level, for instance? Right? How do you make sense out of that? I'm not going to sit here and, you know, jiggle air molecules about that endlessly, but just put that challenge, you know. The challenges that those Brahmanic philosophers faced are your challenges too. In studying this book is, you know, many orders of magnitude more complicated than anything that they did, and they said this, like, you know, that this was truly one of the most noble reaches of the mortal mind into the domains of philosophy and metaphysics. Okay, you've got to go way beyond that noblest to get yourself into the full depths of what's going on in paper 105 and stuff like that.
It's pretty encouraging that, you know, with this kind of philosophic rocket fuel combined with that kind of earnest effort, you can do a lot.
You know, and if that's not your thing, to push that far, the degree to which you do go, do it remembering that depth that you have not plumbed, right? So that you don't falsely absolutize and existentialize your beginning level of recognition, right? Keep it in context, right? It will help you immensely to have that at least awareness of profound depths that you haven't plumbed yet. Anything else there? Anyone else have any other questions on that? I don't think there's any. I don't think there's anything else we need to say there. The next time we'll get into, there's one final section before they go on to China. so we'll flesh out sort of the what the final picture is when you go from merely Brahmanism to Hinduism. Yeah, so you've got this Vedism to Brahmanism to Hinduism. And that will wrap that up. You know, and we'll remember we had a question about Krishna, for instance. I think it was that last week or whatever. You know, I mean, we'll, you know, you can see where that fits in and whatnot if you don't already appreciate that. And then, like I said, then we'll move on to all the complexities in the Far East. All right, let's take a moment here, everyone.